In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. So the scene is in some ways largely imagined. It's inferred from some of the things that C.S. Lewis wrote in his book, A Grief Observed. So it's sort of imagined, a reconstructed moment. For any of you, know what I'm talking about. The movie Shadowlands, which we've referred to on several occasions in the series, is the story of C.S. Lewis's later life when he ends up meeting, befriending, and then marrying an American woman by the name of Joy Gresham, at first just to keep her in the country because she's not a British woman. She was American. And then later, having been married, they fell in love. And so they lived and loved, and then she contracted bone cancer. And within several years, she died. And in this scene, in the wake of her death, C.S. Lewis comes downstairs to have dinner with his colleagues at Oxford. And they're as awkward to be around him as he is uncomfortable to be in that setting once again. He'd been kind of a reclusive after her death for a while. But he comes downstairs, and all of his colleagues make the obligatory pleasantries and condolences. And his rival, Christopher, says, "Is there anything I can do, Jack?" And Lewis says, "No, just don't tell me that everything is for the best." And then sort of the Anglican churchman that's part of their little coterie by the name of Harry says, "Only God knows why these things happen." And then Lewis responds rather acidly, "God knows, but does God care?" And that scene doesn't end without C.S. Lewis erupting almost in a fit for just a moment, sort of deducing from his experience that though God may be in charge, he and everyone else in this creation is more like a lab rat, and God is at best a vivisectionist. That's his call in the moment. And even though the moment is largely reconstructed, there are elements of that that you find if you read his book, A Grief Observed, that kind of curiosity. God may be there, but does God care? For those of you that are just joining us, we are in a series. We're on the penultimate sermon of a series on suffering, on the redemption of our suffering. And every week we have looked at a different storyline of the Bible that is intersected by suffering. We have seen Adam and Eve in the garden. We have seen Israel in Egyptian bondage. We have heard from David in his sin. We have heard from Job in his incomprehensible suffering. We've heard from Jeremiah in his efforts to live righteously. And last week we heard from Mary and Martha and the loss of their brother Lazarus. This morning, we are going to look at a storyline of suffering with Jesus himself. Jesus has played a part in every one of these sermons, obviously. Today he is front and center. And in this storyline of suffering, the question that we're bringing to it that we think he is out to answer is this question that's at the bottom of every believing person's suffering. Does God care? Does God care that I should suffer as I am? Jesus will answer that question, and he will answer it in his own suffering. And we're going to learn how it is, in fact, that God cares for us in our suffering by four aspects of Jesus' experience in suffering: what he embodied, what he endured, what he accomplished, and what he inherited. What he embodied, what he endured, what he accomplished, what he inherited. We're in a famous passage in the book of Isaiah, chapter 52. Starting in verse 13, would you stand? In Isaiah 52, beginning in verse 13. "Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high, lifted up, and shall be exalted. As many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind, so shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him, for that which has not been told them they see, and that which they have not heard they understand. Who has believed what he has heard from us? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised, rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised. We esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs, carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, for he was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, like a sheep that before its shears is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation who considered that he was cut off of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people, they made his grave with the wicked, and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth, yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous. And he shall bear their iniquities. And therefore I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. All right, first things first. We take it as a given that this text is talking about Jesus. But let's not take it for granted for just a moment. Because a lot of Israelites didn't, and a lot of rabbis didn't. There are a lot of rabbis that thought that this servant is referring to Israel, because in other places in Isaiah, the servant is used as a collective plural noun. Here, it's in the singular. Elsewhere, it's in the plural. And so they thought, that's just talking about Israel. But how does Israel save Israel? Came one argument. And that's why others might have thought, well, okay, so it's not Israel. It must be the remnant that Israel, that Isaiah is talking about, a faithful few. But in Isaiah's world, there's only two kinds of people. There's wicked Israel, and then there's this remnant. So who's the remnant out to save? Who's the remnant out to die for? And so that argument fell. And that's why some rabbis at least had to admit to the fact, this apparently is pointing to some enigmatic individual. And that's why they postulated, maybe it's Jeremiah, or maybe it's somebody else. But that person seems to fit whatever this description is. Brothers and sisters, my argument to you is that the more you know about Jesus, the more you think, he fits the profile of what we've just heard. So let's talk about that profile. Let's talk about that profile that is meant to communicate to us, to prove to us that, in fact, God does care for you in your suffering. And the first way we know is in what Jesus embodied. What did he embody? What's true of Jesus just from the description of who he is according to this passage? It's really simple. What did he embody? Utter unexceptionality. I had to look that word up to make sure that was the right word for it. Utter unexceptionality, meaning totally unremarkable, not worth thinking about, not worth giving a second thought. It speaks of him there in verse 2 of chapter 53, that he comes forth like a sprout in the desert. You stop at an intersection, and if your mind and your eyes wander outside the window while there's a red light, and you look at the scene there in the concrete, what do you see? Oh, a weed. a little verge that nobody ever thinks about, that nobody ever comes to cure or to remove, or maybe they remove with insecticide, just something that you never think about, the verge that is just inconsequential to you. That's what this is referring to about Jesus. Utterly unremarkable. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him. Isaiah is talking about a servant whose entrance into the world was no royal birth attended by hordes or crowds. There was nothing to write home about concerning his appearance. And if that's talking about Jesus, then that makes a lot of sense. Because, yeah, angels appear to shepherds. But who appears to Jesus? Livestock and smelly shepherds and a bunch of enigmatic astrologers. Not exactly a big crowd. Not exactly a highfalutin experience. And the unexceptionality of this servant doesn't stop with his advent into the world. It says he was despised, rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, as one from whom men hide their faces. This is talking about someone who walks the earth largely misunderstood, frequently derided, and often disappointed. And if you follow the life of Jesus, you've just described the life of Jesus. He was acquainted with being misunderstood. He was familiar with being derided and often felt disappointed, and often disappointed because of those in whom he had most confided. He gets this. This is descriptive of him. Now, those who had no reputation, they're the ones that adore Jesus. But the right people, the ones with prestige and reputation and a network, they were either bemused by him or incensed by him. Now, there were exceptions. A Roman centurion, a rabbinical scholar named Nicodemus, some Greeks that had heard just enough that they wanted to say, hey, who is this Jesus guy? Can we talk to him? They saw past his unremarkable exterior into his enigmatic noteworthiness, and they said, I want to get more. I want to know more. But they're the exceptions. That he is so blithely dismissed and so roundly rejected is in part became because he came with none of the trappings of prestige. And therefore, it's right to say that he embodies unexceptionality. He embodies unremarkableness. Now, the question, therefore, for you is, why in the world would that prove to you that God cares for you in your suffering? Brothers and sisters, it's when you suffer that you are reduced. Life gets smaller. No matter how much you might learn from suffering or how much you might grow in suffering, you can't help but acknowledge that when you suffer, something is taken from you. That what you once had is no longer yours. You may not be entirely unhinged by what you suffer, but those hinges get loose and they creak when they turn. Everything is not the same because when we suffer, we are reduced. And as those who are reduced in their suffering, they know something about what it's like to be avoided. For whatever reason you might be suffering, you almost walk around with this sign, this radioactive sign on you that many would prefer not to get close to. Because it reminds them of things that they don't want to remember or engage. It puts them in moments that they don't know how to handle. And in being reduced by our suffering, it's almost like we become leprous in some people's minds, even if though they would never admit it and want to act upon those impulses. And so, brothers and sisters, by way of contrast, isn't it true that those who look past the ways in which we've been reduced by our suffering, those who look past our degradation and the way in which we are diminished, aren't they the most precious to us? Isn't it so that when those set aside their feelings of discomfort or fear about what we're facing in our suffering, it's those that we cherish? We love them because they get us and they're not repelled by us. And in that, they care for us. And so, brothers and sisters, this servant who embodies unremarkableness, who was reduced by his circumstances and afflictions, he gets you. He knows you. He cares for you. because he knows that in your suffering, you embody unwillingly what he chose to embody willingly. That's one reason why we can say that even if you're suffering, that doesn't mean God doesn't care for you. There's another reason why we can say he cares for you too. Not just in what he embodied, but also in what he endured. What his life embodied goes hand in hand with the experience that he endured. And while what he embodied was more sort of like a chronic affliction, what he endured was unimaginably acute. So what did he endure? He took upon himself burdens that were not his own. Surely he's borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, it says in verse 4. It is the true friend, the true mourner, who does not keep your pain at a distance, but enters into it and feels it, so to speak, a little bit vicariously with you. But for them to do that is an emotional weight. It comes at cost to them. This servant, the one whom we find perfectly exemplified in Jesus, is the one who bore up a real and weighty burden, and by his own choice. That's part of what he endured, but it's only a part. Because he also endured wounds for our errors. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. That's the language of taking on the responsibility for somebody else's errors. And the responsibility comes in the form of putting on a very painful restitution on their behalf. If you're a neighbor of a family whose house burns down, and that house burned down because of some negligent act of the kid in the house, you, in some sense, shoulder the burden with them in being a support to them and their loss. But if you're the parent of that kid, and that kid had acted negligently, and your house now stands, or rather lies, in ruin, and then the authorities, in some sense, press charges for your negligence, for improperly supervising your child, it is a qualitatively different experience. You are not the one who committed the offense, but you are accountable for it now. This servant sees the house that you've burned down, the house that, so to speak, God has given you, but then he is taking responsibility for your offense. And he endures that. For that, and in this servant, he knows oppression and deprivation. He has oppressed and afflicted, and yet he didn't open his mouth, it says in verse 10. And he knows, in enduring that, a certain indignity. Because it says in verse 9, they made his grave with the wicked. No commendation. No reputation. So what does all that amount to? If you had to summarize, fine. What does he endure? How could you put that in a simple phrase? Here it is. This servant endured pain undeserving. Isaiah is writing into a moment in which Israel is under the judgment of God, and this servant is in some sense caught up in that judgment, but this servant is not responsible for that judgment. It's not for his errors that he is caught up in the judgment. He is the one who has let pain overtake him, even if it was not on account of his actions. And so we ask the question again, how does that help you in your suffering? How does that prove that God cares for you in your suffering? We have spoken in this series of moments in which your suffering can be attributed to heinous and grievous sin. We've talked about that. But for most of this series, we have talked about suffering that has nothing to do with personal culpability. And most suffering is of that nature: unsolicited, unmerited, undeserving. A man can look down at his watch for just an instant and not see the oncoming truck, and then he is a quadriplegic for life. An older brother might think that his baby sister was in the house, and then he backs up and he loses that sister. Parents can do everything they can to love their child and do for that child what that child needs, and that child can still refuse to listen, and now they have no idea where he is or if he's even alive. in every one of those cases. None of them signed up for that. They didn't seek it out and they didn't do anything to deserve it. And yet it's theirs. And if that's them, or if that's you, from whom do you find the deepest sense of comfort? From those who have walked in your shoes. From those who know what it is to carry a burden that they didn't provoke. In the same way that the suffering servant of God cares for us in what he embodied, he also cares for us in what he endured. For if Jesus knew what it was to bear a pain that was not his own, then he will surely not hear our cries of lament with unsympathetic or unknowing ears. You and I have an instinct. When we are suffering, we tend to keep to ourselves what is burdening us when we are around those who cannot identify with our pain. And that's natural because they don't get it. They can't get it, or it's hard for them to get it. And we hold all that in and all that we fear because we think that they will just not understand. With Jesus, brothers and sisters, we have no such reason to hesitate. Because he understands undeserving pain. He has felt the rawness of existence for which there is no neat and tidy explanation. In that describes his very life. And in that is our sense of his care for our suffering. He had plenty of undeserved pain. But this servant's suffering was not wholly inexplicable or purposeless. And that's the third thing I want to tell you about that I think proves to us that God cares for us in our suffering. It's in what Jesus, the servant, accomplishes that proves God's care. In verse 4, we hear of how he saw to the unburdening of sorrows. What sorrows, though? The miseries of life that we all kind of run into, the sad contours of disappointed dreams. Is that the sorrows, or is it the way that even the best things of life, that they kind of lose their glory and their luster over time just because that's this world? Are those the sorrows? No. The sorrows that he unburdens us of are what's come through us and what's come in us to drive a wedge between us and love. Last week we said that suffering seeks most and does best to steal love from us, to squelch it, to annihilate it altogether. And in that is a deep sorrow. But the sorrows and griefs referred to here is talking about something constitutional in us. Something descriptive of our very nature that's expressed in all manner of attitudes and actions. And it's that constitutional nature that leads us to despise and reject the God in whose image we bear. We disregard his love and his claim upon us. And that time and time again has rendered us accountable before him. And as the psalmist elsewhere says, if you counted iniquity against us, who could stand? And God says of himself, I am merciful and slow to anger, but I will by no means clear the guilty. He doesn't look past sin. He can't look past sin. But to be merciful, he lays our repudiation of love upon another who will bear the divine reproach. And by that, it says in verse 5, we're healed. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we're healed. That, brothers and sisters, is the gospel in an incipient but evocative form. We are the sheep who think we know how to govern ourselves, provide for ourselves, and protect ourselves. But like sheep, all we know is how to get ensnared, exposed, and endangered, whether it's at our hands or the hands of others. And the more we insist on our autonomy, the further we get from his love. But rather than give up on us, he instead came for us in the one who came as a servant, who became the embodiment of an unremarkable slave who endured the suffering, despising the shame of it all. And in taking upon himself, we're healed. Our guilt is acquitted. I pray that you hear the gospel in this setting every week. Lord willing. But we have to ask ourselves here again, how is what this Jesus accomplished meant to show his care for us in our suffering? Forgive me if all I'm about to do is repeat myself from what I said in the first week of this series. But part of what enables us to face our suffering is to see our suffering in scale. Unless and until we take stock of our suffering in an ultimate context, our suffering will always and forever feel like it's an ultimate reality. What this servant Jesus accomplished for us sets before us another reality, a deeper one, one that insists that our deepest affliction has nothing to do with an estranged relationship or a terminal diagnosis. What this servant accomplishes has bearing on how we think about our saddest day and our longest travail. It has to, or if it means nothing. Now, what he accomplished, brothers and sisters, in no way minimizes or belittles or chastises us in our grief for those other things, those other pains we're experiencing. It does not. He weeps at death. But it does rescue us from thinking ourselves utterly consumed by what we suffer. If the gospel is true and there is forgiveness for sin and the suffering of the servant, then even if the cancer should take me, I am not utterly taken. For in what he has accomplished, my greatest affliction is remedied. When the four friends of the invalid cut a hole in their neighbor's roof, hope they paid for that. When they bring their friend who has not walked and they bring him to Jesus, why does Jesus first say, "Your sins are forgiven," before he ever says anything about "rise and take up your pallet"? It wasn't just to prove that he had authority to forgive sins. That was certainly central to the moment. It was to remind them and us that there is something worse than being an invalid. There is something worse than losing your mind. There is something worse than losing your whole family in a plane crash. As awful and heinous, as unimaginably painful as any of those things might be, what's worse is being far from the heart of God. And it's therefore in what the servant accomplished that we have proof of God's care in what we suffer. Even when you suffer, you can't say that God doesn't care. And that goes hand in hand with the last evidence of that care. This servant embodies unremarkableness. He endures undeserving pain. And he accomplishes a glory we cannot measure for those who take refuge in him. But he will not, as it were, ride into the sunset such that we say to him, "Hey, we hardly knew you." It says in verse 10, "When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied." This servant, Isaiah says, has an inheritance coming his way. Somehow, after all he has suffered, being like a lamb to the slaughter, having his grave made with the wicked, someday, somehow, his days will not be cut short. Enjoy that little paradox. He shall have length of days and offspring aplenty. He will have blessing for his faithfulness, even his enthusiasm to pray for those who transgressed. For all that, he is rewarded what is immeasurable. When Jesus rises from the dead, he does more than secure forgiveness for those who find him. He also secures, the New Testament says, an inheritance for them. One that is kept in heaven, one that is imperishable, such that everything that is now belonging to Jesus now belongs to those who have faith in him. Get ready, that's what Advent will all be about. The gifts of our union. And what that means for someone who suffers is that even in unrecoverable loss, what we have in Jesus is an irrevocable gain. In this life, no doubt there will be anxiety and sorrow in everything that you can, may, and eventually will lose. No doubt. You're not supposed to be stoic. Tears make sense. It is painful. But that's why you and I have to, on a regular occasion, do what the psalmist says in Psalm 16, where he says, "Set the Lord ever before me, and take counsel in him." Because it's in the inheritance that is his and becomes ours by faith that, in a sense, we sense his care for us in our suffering. What does all this mean for us? It means this. If the child that you loved and seen depart continues to prefer estrangement, let me remind you, God's love is not bound. His care is still real. If the tumor hasn't shrunk, but it's grown, God still cares for you. If the sonogram reveals another mishap, God still cares for you. And if all they can recommend is hospice, God still cares for you. C.S. Lewis's experience questioning God's goodness or if he cares is not an uncommon experience. He even lost the interest in shaving. If you read his memoir, A Grief Observed, he wondered, "Well, who cares if my cheek is smooth or rough?" It's emblematic of anyone's experience in the wake of loss. Wondering if God even cares is an understandable deduction that one might make when the bottom has dropped out of your world. But as he writes at the end of that memoir, A Grief Observed, he says, "Grief is like a long valley, a winding valley where any bend may reveal a totally new landscape. But when I lay these questions before God, I get no answer, but a rather special sort of no answer. It's not the locked door. It's more like a silent, certainly not uncompassionate gaze, as though he shook his head, not in refusal, but waving the question like saying, 'Peace, child, you just don't understand.'" He wondered aloud if God cared. And through the experience, he discovered all the more reason why he could believe that. What Christ embodies, endures, accomplishes, and inherits prove that. But brothers and sisters, that evidence is not like an overpowering thought. It is more like the faint melody of a songbird at dawn. And that's why I've quoted on the front of your bulletin a passage from a poem by Christian Wiman, who said this in that poem: "I do not know how to come closer to God except by standing where a world is ending for one man. And praise to the light that is not yet, the dawn in which one bird believes, crying not as if there had been no night, but as if there were no night in which it had not been." What does God prove to us of his care for us in Jesus? It is not to say to us that there is no night. It is to say to us that there is no night in which he has not been. Hear the melody of the songbird and let that melody hold you. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.